This is Under Lock and Key.
South African poet and revolutionary Denis Brutus speaks about the struggle against prisons, imperialism, and the death penalty.
Welcome to Under Lock and Key, news and commentary about prisons from the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League. The U.S. incarcerates a greater percentage of its population than any other country, sending more black men to prison than to college. The purpose of this program is to educate about and inspire activism against the American lockdown.
On April 17, South African poet and revolutionary Denis Brutus spoke at a teach-in on the criminal justice system. The teach-in was organized by the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League. For his work against the apartheid regime, Denis Brutus was exiled from South Africa. He was a political prisoner for a number of years, spending 18 months on Robben Island breaking rocks with Nelson Mandela. Brutus remains a revolutionary activist today. This program will play excerpts from his speech at this teach-in.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. I'm going to talk about a few things. I thought I would begin by reminding you of a statement which was published in Rail Notes, just the opening lines, which points out that Rail works in cooperation with prisoners and in opposition to prisons. But that's in the larger context of a very much bigger struggle. It is a central part of the organizing against imperialism and the neoliberal global agenda of our time, which is just the latest manifestation of the expansion of capitalism into this later phase of a kind of, one might even say we now have a kind of supercharged imperialism in our time, and one might look at that, if we had time, simply in terms of the post-Cold War development of a new global agenda, which in some ways is an extension of a larger previous agenda. Doing a program for Pacifica recently, I suggested that we should think about, for some people at least, there's what they call a millennial hegemonic agenda. They're talking of, come the end of the century, we are going to run the world and nobody's going to stop us. And we will have the capacity, the power to strike anywhere, anytime, at anybody, and when we choose to demonize them, from that point onwards, that's the demon, you know. And if you no longer have an enemy, then you create an enemy. And if you can't find any other enemy, then you start saying that all over the world. Matter of fact, everybody is a terrorist. It can happen any old time, any old place. Therefore, we have to have the right to strike anywhere. So all the pieces begin to fit together. And I think we should be aware of that. And I'll offer some ideas. Admittedly, some of them are speculative, and you will react and give your responses to it. But I think there is a way of fitting the pieces together like a jigsaw puzzle so that they add up and they make sense. So I'm going to just now focus on one area, because this, in a way, is why I've come here today. I think that the project of books for prisoners and free books for prisoners is an extremely important one. Ever since it was started, I've been a supporter and I will continue to be a supporter. One of the elements of our struggle has to be prisoners, has to be the education of prisoners. Has to be the understanding that prisoners are in a very special way the victims of an oppressive system. Most of us are in some degree or other, but prisoners in a very special way are the victims of the system. And they're the victims in several ways, and I'm sure we'll get into this in our discussion, but I was very struck listening to a professor of law speaking in Denver on the steps of the Capitol at the time when they were opening one of those maximum security prisons at a place called Florence. And he pointed out that if you look at the statistics, every year you will read that the number of crimes being committed is going down all over the country. And police forces are very pleased to report this, and the federal government is very pleased to report it. But simultaneously, as there's a steady decline in the number of crimes committed, there's a steady increase in the number of people in prison. And this is black and white. We're not even talking race now. We're just talking raw statistics. So this is kind of contradiction between the reduction of crime but increase of criminals. And he suggested very seriously that, in fact, prisons were not really about crime, about something else. They are about control. And they are about control of the potential menace in the society, of disruptive elements in that society, as the gap between rich and poor widens. You have more dispossessed, homeless, unemployed, and desperate people. And you have to control them. And so that's one of the strategies of control. And as I say, this is a matter on which people can have different interpretations. But it seems to me that is one aspect that we ought to be considering very seriously. I think there's someone else last night in our discussion who raised another point about prisoners that I think was very interesting. And that is that, in fact, in prison, a remarkably large people, number of prisoners, become politically conscious. They have the opportunity to ask themselves, how the heck did I get here? What brought me here? And of course there are all the simplistic explanations. In fact, there are people who will tell you that some human beings have a crime gene, you know, that they are born inheriting a tendency to be criminal. And so you have that kind of absurdity on the one hand. But there are people who begin to look at the society which made them what they are, put them in the situation where they found themselves committing crime, and then asking questions about the society. What kind of society is it? That's, of course, apart from the people who discover the inequities in the law and the way they are differential punishment, and particularly how the law discriminates on racial grounds. All those are elements that can be discovered in prison. You confront the reality, you begin to understand it. And of course, we have this striking disproportion in the population between, say, having a 10% minority population in the population as a whole, but that same minority will turn out to be 30%. Of the prison population, so that there's a clear disparity between the percentage of the population of a given Hispanic, black, whatever group you like, and then the figure for that group when you examine the prison population. And as you know, there's been extensive, soundly based scholarly research which has established the clearly evident racial bias when it comes to the death penalty and the number of people who are sentenced to death. And a Judge Szabo, who holds the record for having sentenced more people to death than any other judge in the U.S., is not an exception. Szabo is just one of the many judges across the country who have sentenced people to death, and in his case, a particularly blatant example of one who consistently excluded evidence which might have exculpated Mumia, or at the very least would have forced a re-examination of the fact And that is one reason why we are demanding a new trial, because whatever else you may think about Mumia and whatever your doubts may be, one thing is clear, he did not get a fair trial. No one can dispute that. That relevant evidence was excluded. It's on the record that Sabo refused to admit evidence which was relevant to the case, and which would have cast serious doubt, more than merely reasonable doubt, on the man's guilt. And so I hope many of us will be in Philadelphia next week. And those who can't be there, I hope people are going to organize local events. I'm also encouraged by news of student action. I got a call from Montana, a little town called Missoula, which I had trouble finding on the map. But they're sending busloads down to Philadelphia, and the students are organizing a walkout of the classes as well. So that it's happening all over the country. And perhaps you should just pause on that for a moment, and I'll offer you my own reading. I was in Paris in December being honored together with people like Geronimo, Angela Davis, Rigoberto Menchu, Estival from Argentina, people being honored for their various contributions to human rights. And Danielle Mitterrand was there, the widow of the former prime minister, I guess. And then we had a rally outside the U.S. Embassy in the Place de la Concorde in the center of Paris, with all the buses and cabs passing by, hooting their support. You know, and it is a fact that Mumia's case is a cause célèbre. It's an international issue all over the world, and we have to keep building this issue. We have, I believe, and I tend to be excessively optimistic anyway, but I tend to believe this is a case we can win. I think you have to keep your eyes fixed on the prize, and the prize is saving this man's life and going beyond that to challenging the whole notion of the death penalty, demanding the abolition of the death penalty. I come from a country where two of my closest friends were hanged. I know what the death penalty is about. One of them was a leader of a choir, a great bass voice. When he sang, it was like Paul Robeson, and he'd make the floorboards vibrate. Avusi Muyisili was his name. He was hanged, came from my hometown, Port Elizabeth, was hanged in Pretoria. The other one was a white South African called John Harris, beaten up by the police before he was hanged. They smashed his jaw, and he went to the gallows singing, "We Shall Overcome," with a broken jaw. But he was there, you know, willing to die on a gallows that was sticky with the blood and the slime and the vomit and the urine and the excreta of others who had been hanged on that gallows, because they didn't bother to clean them. They were just hanging them one after another. But South Africa today has abolished the death penalty. There is no death penalty in South Africa today. And so we have to go on, you know, with the struggle, but let's never lose sight of the fact that Mumia is only one of over 3,000 people on death row in this country. Over 3,000 on death row in this country. And some of them juveniles. This country leads the world in killing people who are not yet adults, who are not yet 18, but they can be executed in this country as if they were adults. So we have to deal with that, but as I say, it's important to repeat that Mumia is just a very convenient symbol, fortunately. I hope not to sound too cynical, but he is about the battle to end the death penalty. It's about Mumia, but it's about a whole lot more than Mumia. And this is what everybody understands when I speak at international audiences. They know, because they, as in France, for instance, have already abolished the death penalty. They know that this is about the death penalty, that that's the central issue that has to be dealt with. I'm going to leave that, and hopefully we can return to it at discussion time. I want to pick up just on something I was listening to in one of the workshops. I just dropped in at the end. But it raised for me a very relevant issue, and an issue which is very much in my mind at the present time because of what I'm currently engaged in. Mumia for me is an important issue, but it's not my principal issue. You have to, of course, because we all have many things to do, you have to select a primary cause that you give most of your energy to. And I like to be with those that I think I can win, of course.
This has been Under Lock and Key, a Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League program about prisons. For more information, contact RAIL, P.O. Box 712, Amherst, Massachusetts 01004, or email railradio@mim.org.